You're listening to the podcast of the Biopharmaceutical Section of the American Statistical Association.
Statistics.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the podcast of the Biopharmaceutical Section of the American Statistical Association. This is episode 26, and it's a topic I've been trying to chase down now for some time. The topic is data transparency and data sharing. I was fortunate enough to sit down with a number of individuals at the 2015 ASA Biopharm Workshop in Washington, D.C., and we had a conversation about what data transparency means, where the industry is currently at, and what the implications are for data transparency for the future of research and drug development. I hope you enjoy it. And since this is the final podcast for 2015, I want to wish everyone a happy holiday season and a very happy new year. Let's listen to the podcast.
Today I'm talking with Michael Hale, Global Head of Biometrics at Baxalta, Jonathan Hartzell, Director of Biostatistics at Merck & Company, Sarah Hughes, Vice President and Head of Clinical Statistics at GlaxoSmithKline, Ted Listig, Director, Corporate Biostatistics at Medtronic, and last but not least, Estelle Russick-Cohen, Division Director at the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research at the FDA. Good afternoon to everyone. So for the benefit of the listeners, can you describe what data transparency means? For example, why do we care so much about whether we can see through our data? It's a bad joke, but just to get us started off.
Well, I think, you know, it starts with having access to data, but it's really much more than that, in my opinion. I think you need to reveal your intentions. A data set is just a pile of numbers unless you put context to it, and so what we need to be doing is to provide data, if we're having data transparency, along with the context in which the data was collected. That means things like the protocol, the SAP. The time frame might be important, too, and I don't know quite how we do that, because a protocol and a SAP from 2015 is going to feel different if it's from 1995, just because the clinical environment was different. But I think the intentions, why are we doing the study, why was the data collected, and the conditions under which were collected are all part of the data transparency perspective.
I think it's also fair to say as well that data transparency means a variety of things. I think the industry generally has been on a data transparency journey for several years now, going from posting clinical trial results summaries on internet registries through to making clinical study reports publicly available. And I think the latest step around making the actual individual patient data available is in recognition of the fact that even with that summary information available, there is more we can do and more we can learn from data that might well inform medical research.
I think that's a good point, thinking about how the standards have changed. Another way to think about data transparency is, what is the information that a sponsor can hide behind relative to a consuming audience? And there was a point in time when it was considered that you're only concerned about them diverging the fact that they ran a trial, what the key results were. So this is clinicaltrials.gov. Say, well, we just need to know what's out there. Then we started moving to a point where we're saying, no, you actually should be sharing the information down to a patient level, but we're still talking about the data directly used to support the original analyses. Now there's also some call in additional cases to say you want data down to the patient narrative. So I do think that there are situations where the amount of transparency is in some sense related to the degree of question. And we need to have a conversation as a society and as a group about, well, how far should we be going down this path? Because there's things that are nice to know and there's things that are need to know, and we need to make more of that balance going forward.
You know, I think along with that, the users of the data, so data transparency from say the industry perspective, the sponsors, means one thing, you know, and then the users, you know, as we get more complicated or we give more and more, there's potential for data over, you know, override. I mean, they're going to be given a lot of information. You know, we can provide all the documentation, as Mike suggested, which is a very good thing. But when it gets down to them actually using this information, you know, understanding all the nuances in all the data that we collect, you know, it's going to be a lot for them to kind of take on.
Well, I keep hoping this will improve future clinical trials. And so from an agency perspective, I think the more we learn by looking at the data and maybe going across trials within the same drug classes, maybe we'll learn how to design the next trials better, possibly more efficiently, because I'm not convinced we're as efficient as we could be, and that would be a really useful thing for both companies, FDA, and frankly, patients, because it does drive the cost up.
Were there any specific events that motivated the need for data transparency? So a particular analysis or clinical program that just sort of kicked things into high gear that we really need to do something to share?
I keep thinking of Keith Baggerly's work with the Duke clinical trial stuff and how his reanalysis basically shot the conclusions and basically called into question the integrity of some of these modern precision medicine-based kinds of trials, which, you know, has so much hype, and I think it probably set back the hype quite a bit. So people need to trust. They need to trust not only clinical trials and the results that FDA puts up in terms of its summaries and what the companies produce, but the scientific literature. You want to have faith in that as well. So I think transparency sure helps a lot.
I think as well it can be very much a strong question for each organization as what's going to cause them to participate and at what level. So I'm with Medtronic, and for us we had a back therapy that came under a great deal of scrutiny a number of years ago, where there were some claims that the physicians involved in writing the papers had not accurately summarized the adverse event profile and the general usage of the device. And we determined that the best way to meet those criticisms wasn't by going into an argument in the public press about you say this, we say that, but rather to say, well, let's hand off the data to a known critic, Harman Kornholtz at Yale, and say, well, you make an assessment in terms of what data is in here. We aren't going to get involved. Our involvement just is will end at providing the data to you. So I think many organizations are in a state where there might be individuals that are very pro-data transparency and sharing, and others that have good reasons as well for saying, no, we would not go into that of our own free choice. And the balance of the organization as to when there's sufficient will to make the change, because this is a change relative to most organizations, can very likely be driven by sometimes external events or perceptions of activities that are involved in products or otherwise.
Yeah, I think early on that may have started it. I think the ball's rolling now. And you know, the issues now for companies is that company A is doing this with this data transparency, data sharing. Company B is not doing as much. Well, why is company B not doing so much? So I think we're now at a point where we're all having to get to hopefully about the same level, so we all are being, you know, equal sharers. But I agree, you know, these incidents that occur with certain products, you know, where something comes out that maybe the analysis was incorrect or there's some new finding that, you know, somebody overlooked, you know, really puts a black mark, you know, on the company or on the industry as a whole. And so this data sharing and being transparent, and, you know, the hope would be that, you know, we can show them, look, this is everything. You know, you're welcome to look at it, and, you know, hopefully we will all come out with the same results in the end.
I think that's right. I think we can probably all think of high-profile situations where a reanalysis or a meta-analysis has taught us something that maybe was overlooked. But I think also the context is different as well. I think we all now live in a society where an answer like, trust me, I'm a doctor, isn't good enough anymore. I think we all, whether it's pharmaceutical industry or any industry, I think we have different expectations now to the expectations we had 20, 30 years ago, where we want the evidence. We want to see the evidence for ourselves. rather than just trusting somebody else.
Yeah, I think more generally it doesn't even need to be a specific event. I think along what Sarah was saying, the environment is such that we need trust. We don't deal in certainty. We deal in what we believe is probably the case for these drugs. But the fact is there will be some that get to market that prove to not be safe or not effective. And it's, despite best efforts, it's a statistical issue. And statistics inherently means there's some level of uncertainty. You test a drug in thousands and thousands of people. Everything looks great. You go to market and millions of people get it, and you see stuff you didn't see in your trials. And it's not that anybody's being dishonest or deceptive. It's just kind of a, I hate to say a numbers game, but at some level it is a numbers game.
So what are the current regulatory requirements for data sharing? And I'm glad we have someone from the UK to give a perspective, ex-US. So what are those requirements in terms of data sharing?
Well, so, I mean, obviously, as we all know, we are, when we're submitting in the US to the FDA, required to submit the individual patient-level data, not just summary data. In Europe right now, that's not the case, and summary data, summary information is all that we're required to submit. There is, of course, the ongoing conversation with EMA right now. Their thinking in this space is evolving, and we are still awaiting their final guidelines around whether they will require companies who are making a submission to them to post data in some sort of open access way or way that external researchers can obtain access to.
That's an interesting point. I didn't even think about it, that the fact that we give patient-level data to FDA, we've always had some level of data transparency that people just may not have interpreted it that way.
A lot of other regions do not ask for the line data. I think the Japanese are considering it. I believe the Europeans are looking into it. I don't believe Health Canada does. It takes a phenomenal amount of resources. When I ask my staff how they spend their time, it's at least rechecking the primary analysis and any key secondary analyses by actually going into the data set. And that means understanding what was there so that they can figure out how the sponsor generated their particular version of the analysis and do they agree. And once in a while there's a discordance, but most of the companies kind of get it right, but it's still checked.
Can I ask you a question, Estelle?
Sure, go for it.
There are some things that you post from the filing activities, so the any ACM or the summary documents that you write, correct?
That's right. What's actually interesting is the difference between devices and drugs and biologics. For biologic, there's a summary basis for regulatory action. I don't know what it's called in CDER particularly, but that's what we call it. And for devices, it's the summary of safety and effectiveness, the SSED. What's interesting to me when I move from devices over to drugs and biologics is that the individual reviews from the various discipline areas are posted in drugs and biologics, but they're not for devices unless that's really radically changed because I've been out of CDRH for 5 years. You pick up a lot when you look at the individual reviews that you don't pick up from the broader summary document. It sometimes gets redacted because if there's anything that people think is inappropriate to post, they do. But otherwise, it's pretty public, and I think it's there for people to see.
So how is data sharing relevant to statisticians? So we talk about sharing data and making it available. I mean, what kind of statistical issues sort of arise from that? I guess on the one hand, you can think of sort of a classic example in a sequential clinical trial. When you're doing this reanalysis with greater and greater levels of data, you know, we have to account for adjusting the type 1 error so that the fact that we keep doing this analysis over and over again, we don't want to make a false positive. So is there a similar kind of idea that as we accumulate more and more data from more and more trials, do we need to worry about issues with multiplicity?
multiplicity is a little further down the line, I think, in terms of why statisticians are interested. You know, we design studies to answer medical questions, important ones. We get involved in how the data are collected, even reviewing data collection forms. We're involved throughout the cleanup process. We're involved in the analysis, interpretation, reporting. We're involved in every step of the process of putting data sets together. And I don't imagine a world where we wouldn't be extremely involved and interested in data sharing and transparency. We have a deep interest in making sure that the data sets we produce are actually useful and interpretable. And if they're not useful and interpretable, we haven't done our job well.
I'm going to argue that what we need is responsible sharing, and I think that's what Mike was alluding to. The best kind of sharing would be when people come back and say, this is what I really want to do with your data, and here's how I'm going to stick to it. When I moved from academia to FDA, I was surprised by the rigor of a confirmatory analysis. We're going to come up and for our first round to sort of say, what does it take to get the conversation going? This is the key analysis that's going to make us convince us that there's something going on, and then the rest of the discussion follows. I think investigators that want to use company data should not be encouraged to do data dredging any more than we would encourage other people to do it. I do think some degree of responsibility needs to be there. Or if they're going to do an exploratory analysis, then both sides agree that that's what's going to be done and here's what they think they're going to get out of it, so that there's no illusion that they suddenly found something that's going to cause issues and be a problem from a medical perspective, frankly.
Yeah, and I think there was some discussion earlier in the earlier session today that a point was raised about, you know, evaluating the research proposals and potentially offering suggestions back, you know, if someone felt that the research proposal was, you know, not quite on target. And I think that really comes into play in that, you know, we design these clinical trials. We are choosing the population that we're looking at. We are making decisions on certain items in this trial that impact the type of individuals you have in your trial. And then you see a request to do some reanalysis, maybe not trying to replicate the results, but maybe use the data for some other purpose. And some of the decisions that you know that you made for the enrollment or whatever may have a very, you know, strong impact on the type of results they could potentially get out. And I think as a, you know, that's not something they may be able to pick up from just the documentation or readily. And that's where a back and forth might be helpful to, you know, steer them away from coming up with some results that are really more from the way the study was run population-wise than the results being wrong in the data sets.
So I think also what we start talking about here is a combination of both data transparency and data sharing. So from the data sharing aspect, that actually can be tied, because I'm coming from a device perspective, to the use of registries and even something like Sentinel. So Sentinel is set up with a distributed data framework where you have different organizations that work within their own data sets and provide summary information, which is then synthesized across these different organizations. So they're not providing patient-level information in order to make these overall inferences. And there's times they've done some analyses as to, for example, how you can get appropriate survival analyses by sharing, the curves from different groups. But the analyses done for that were saying, I think they were working with, for samples as small as something like 100,000 people. And in devices, I'm in a space where there might not exist 100,000 persons that are indicated for my particular therapy I'm working with. And so it is not the case that I would be able to synthesize a survival curve in a meaningful fashion between multiple organizations. So if I think about how I can share data between different groups in order to make a conclusion, you might even have to move towards things like, well, what is the reduction of my sufficient statistic I'll use in this space? But that might be specific to the analysis I've already done. So we're talking about a reanalysis, but it might not apply if I wanted to do a new analysis. If I want to do a reanalysis, well, I don't actually need time. I just need ranks of failures, right? I can just work with that. But if there's a reason why I want to look at the time profile of what was happening over the course of the study, and that's a new question, then a de-identification procedure that had reduced to ranks would not permit that kind of analysis. So there's all kinds of statistical questions that are very closely tied to these combinations of data transparency and data sharing, and we definitely need to be involved in that.
I think the comments made so far really focus on the critical role we as statisticians have to play in helping with the sharing of the data and supporting the research in terms of its integrity, its validity. But of course, the other aspect that I think we've hardly scratched the surface on yet in this new world of individual patient data sharing is around users of the data. And Estelle mentioned it earlier in the conversation that there's so much information out there that we as industry statisticians could be using to help inform our new trials and development programs to make them much more efficient, to have much better clarity on the likely probability of success of a program or a study. And I think we haven't even really thought to start about that aspect of it.
I was going to say one thing that sort of relates to a conversation we had earlier today and about using research dealing with earlier endpoints being predictive of later endpoints. And there's a lot of interest on how that could inform future trials. And so only capturing what happens at the last look might not work for all research questions of interest. And it seems to me this adaptive enrichment, which people would be very excited about, could only come when you have some data sets to sort of look at, to sort of motivate the kinds of questions you might want to evaluate.
So you brought up a good point, Sarah, that the exercise of data transparency shouldn't be viewed as a punishment for the pharmaceutical industry, but that there's actually some real gains that pharmaceutical companies and medical researchers in general can get out of sharing this data, even though the hurdles and the challenges with it are very high.
I just want to jump on that point for a moment. It's helpful to start thinking about the stated motivation for data sharing from different sources. So EMA has come more with the approach that access to the knowledge of what happened during clinical trials is a societal right. Society needs to know they have the duty to share the information. HHS put out a notice in the Federal Register about 2 years ago now, maybe two and a half, time passes, asking for comments about a proposal for data sharing. And that was motivated more along the lines that if companies were to share data with one another, it would facilitate the faster development of products and allow patients to get medication sooner. So it wasn't so much the data needs to be free, but rather there's an untapped potential to improve the process of developing therapies that would only be able to be leveraged if data were shared. And so that colors the types of conversations we have. I mean, the FDA, while they are given patient-level data by the sponsors, because that's a requirement, they have their hands tied with respect to legislation in terms of how they could share that information or how they could synthesize it. So we really need to consider other avenues, such as companies agreeing to work directly with one another, if we want to pursue these other goals, which can be appropriate in some cases, of trying to find ways to improve the development of medicines and get them to patients faster.
And actually, if I look at the statistics from the since GSK started sharing its individual patient data and the types of research proposals being submitted, it's a very small minority of proposals that are focused on checking the integrity, the validity of the original research findings. The vast majority are really around other questions, trying to learn additional things from the information, the data that we have.
So I'd like to talk about some of the challenges of data sharing, in particular, anonymizing data. So, of course, it's important to anonymize data. For example, there's gender, age, race, and other demographic variables that can potentially unmask patients when the data is shared. Are there other data going beyond demographic characteristics that potentially make it very straightforward to identify patients? And if so, how in general do we go about anonymizing data so we can protect patient privacy but also have data that's useful when we perform an analysis?
So in some level that it can be very study specific in terms of the type of data that
you are collecting. You've highlighted some of the demographic information that certainly can be used, and there's some common things that other items that, you know, related to AE terms and other things that could be identifying. And there's always the could. I mean, that's one of the issues. This is all theoretical risk of somebody who has, you know, a purposeful, is purposely trying to re-identify individuals. And you know, if you read some of the literature, you know, there's different camps in terms of you have the one individual who already knows that somebody's in a trial, so now they're going to go look for that person. And so then that's a very different scenario because they have specific information about that person and know that they were in a trial. So that makes their life a lot easier. And then you have, so there's different categories of the perpetrator that would be trying to re-identify. And this all goes by the fact that, you know, is somebody really trying to re-identify? But the type of information we have in that trial, if it's information that could potentially re-identify them, will depend on the population that individual is coming from with all those what they call quasi-identifiers. They're not the names, they're not Social Security numbers, but in combination, the demographic information or potential medical history or other items that could be used to, you know, narrow down. And it may not be a 100% re-identification. It may be, I got it down to a 25% chance that this is the right person. And that's what you're dealing with. And so it's very study-dependent and population-dependent.
You need to be careful that you can't bridge clinical trial data to other data that's up on the web. So, for example, clinicaltrials.gov may actually indicate which sites participated in the study, and then you suddenly go back and say, I have a 70-year-old who I know goes to site X. There's a good chance it's that person. Geocoding is definitely an issue, and I kind of wonder in devices in particular, there's very strong site-to-site variability relating to surgeon skill. What happens when you remove the geocoding? Have you impaired some aspects of the analysis? And so I do think you need to understand what the trade-offs are.
And this really is a very important topic at the moment. An example I was giving in my talk earlier today was that while different sponsors take different approaches, use different methods to anonymization, that in itself has the risk of then leading to false inappropriate conclusions in subsequent analyses when pooling data across sponsors. So, for example, if one sponsor redacts information, raw adverse event text, and then just provides the coded adverse event information, whereas another sponsor does the same thing but takes an extra step, and if there are any coded adverse event terms that are for rare events, and they decide to redact those in order to reduce risk further of re-identifying a patient, then a simple meta-analysis comparing the drugs from each of those sponsors might yield a conclusion of an increased risk of the rare event with that second drug versus the first drug. And so I think we do need to think very carefully about this area and really try to move towards a common standard for anonymization as quickly as possible.
So given these challenges, is it even possible to share genomic data in an anonymized fashion? Or you all started laughing, so.
I'll just relate an anecdote. And it's been close to 3 years since I heard this, but it really struck me. I was driving home in the car, and NPR had a piece about a study where it had been published in something on the order of Science or Nature. It was less than 10 people. They were looking at a very rare outcome. And they had posted the genetic information, the sequencing, for the persons involved in this study. And some researchers took that less than 10-person study with that genetic information and knowing the disease in question and then used external information. They went to Facebook. They were looking for persons of a certain background that was prone to this disease, and they could tell, you know, you can tell gender directly by the genetic information, and were able to identify by name for the persons in this study based solely on the genetic information. So that is frightening, I think, And so the concept of our ability to meaningfully de-identify, it gets really hard. And I think something else that we can consider as well is that there may be, if you think about a study moving over in time, we might have to actually consider sort of a dynamic amount of de-identification that goes on. Because your risk when you've got four persons in the study versus 40 persons in the study versus 400 persons in the study, there's a very different scenario in terms of how many patients are like you in there. So the standards change.
Well, and I think even if you're dealing with very large trials, if you're studying a rare event, one, you're going to, so we had an 8,000 plus subject trial where the primary endpoint, there were only 42. And of those, for those 42 individuals, you wrote very exhaustive narratives about the type of events they had. So there was just a lot of information because they're most important. They were, for us, the most important individuals or in that entire trial. And so it's those situations where you've spelled out a lot of detail, on a couple individuals that potentially could be very useful. And I think your point about over time, I was just thinking, well, what can we do now from a technology perspective? And then think about what can we do in 10 years with say, our DNA. And so, you might put stuff out now that we can't do a whole lot with, and then, 5 years passes, and all of a sudden we have new techniques, and now that information is very informative, and it's out there now. You can't do anything, but, there's a risk.
Yeah, it's really a currently unresolved issue. We don't have a solution, really. We've got some tentative solutions, but I think it's really work in progress at the moment. And if you look at the history of data we collect, it's changed a lot over the years. When I started doing studies, we routinely got patient initials and birth dates. That was just part of the record. We haven't done that in several years, but it seems like every year we think about more and more things that we need to keep out of the patient record. And it's to the point now where the data we collect in our clinical studies is pretty close to de-identified. It's not completely, but it's about as close as we can get and still do the planned analyses. I don't know if the others want to comment on that, but that's certainly our practice.
One of the questions I have is even in our own summaries of data, and suppose we only have one person in a particular ethnic group, and we're being asked right now to summarize safety and efficacy by race and ethnicity, and shouldn't we have some guidelines about how many should be in a cell before we report it?
Yeah. Well, and I think it's a very good point, and I think in our mindset now, where we are now living under this idea that we must share this data eventually, does that change the way we plan the CSR? Maybe even to the point of collecting of data. I think we talked about it a little bit earlier. This may refine our focus in what we collect so we don't have excessive information. But just in terms of the reporting of it, with the idea you're going to have this CSR out somewhere, potentially redacted, but you're trying to do minimal redactions so that it can be useful, do we pre-plan now certain ways or change the ways we report just to try and make things simpler at that end?
So Estelle had also talked about this idea of what do we report with in terms of the number of cells. And we're very familiar with this idea of not showing enough information if there's too much granularity already there. Think about the ASA salary surveys. Right? You only report, say, the median to start with, and then you start showing the 25th and 75th percentiles, then you start showing the 10th and the 90th, but that's a function of how much data is available. So if you think about performing summaries by subgroups in trials, I think another way potentially to consider this is, because there's a lot of discussions around subgroups today, you start off, before you run the trial, under a null hypothesis that there does not exist a difference between treatments. Right? You're saying, that's my null, there's no difference. Then on the basis, if you're successful from the industry perspective, you have shown that, yes, one treatment differs from another. But then you might start with a null that my assumption is that the treatment is uniform across all the subgroups. Do I have evidence that one subgroup differs from the remaining ones in the group. And perhaps the reporting is only a function of when there exists evidence of difference, you can highlight the difference. But if not, you start with the assumption we don't know that it is different, so you don't report along those lines. I mean, that doesn't agree with the legislative mandate that says the FDA has to report by subgroups, but I think we can perhaps try to come at this a variety of ways, and maybe, for instance, through trying to influence our legislators about the 21st Century Cures legislation. There's other ways to go about it, but it is a problem, and again, this goes back to another one of those reasons why statisticians need to be involved in this process.
I've often wondered why we don't borrow some ideas from the survey literature, because our federal partners have always had guidelines about reporting, including cell sizes and trying to conserve confidentiality when they ask for information. And I wonder if there's some literature and some ideas. I know there's a federal document that provides recommendations. I've often wondered why other groups don't take a look and see how it impacts what they do.
At any given point in time, we may have a set of standards, a set of MEDRA coding that's appropriate. We even have CDIS standards that are making it possible to put data together easier. But even within different companies, there are different flavors of how people interpret CDISC, and the CDISC standards are changing over time, the MEDRA's changing over time. So how do we deal with those challenges and these coding systems and standards that are changing over time?
So this is something I'm living right now. You know, we're putting filings together of a program that's run over the last 10 years, and so we have MEDRA versions from 5 or 6 versions ago, and it's been very interesting for me to run integrated summaries of safety with the most up-to-date MEDRA and see how it's changed from, you know, 3 or 4 years ago when we ran the original CSR. And Estelle, you mentioned in your talk today that from an outcome perspective, the comparison perspective between the groups, things remain the same even with the MEDRA coding. And that's generally what I found. But it's, you know, when we share the data, we're likely sharing just the encoded terms that have come from some verbatim term that verbatim term would have been something different in this day and age if we recoded everything before we shared now. So it's 2015, somebody asked to share asked for our data. We go back to the raw data, rerun it on MEDRA 18, and send it out? No, we're just taking what was there. But it would be different, but researchers are thinking in terms of current day standards. So I think we probably should be acknowledging, you know, how we encoded things. You know, this is from a study 5 years ago, so the MEDRA version was roughly this. I just don't know, you know, one from a resource perspective, if we want to have to go back and recode things just for the sharing, and that coding is going to change every time you share if you do it kind of on demand like some companies do. So I think it's just a point of acknowledging, at least from the perspective of the person receiving the data, of what you're giving them in terms of that version.
So we would always report the version of MEDRA that we're using, as well as the version of our software that we're using, et cetera. That's an important part of the record. But this is always going to be an issue. I can't imagine a time when we're ever going to stop and freeze time and not update coding as we gain more knowledge. And you just can't even anticipate some of these things. One thing I remember from my early days was coming up on an AE that was coded that I'd never seen before, and the study physician asked me, "What is this?" And I said, "I don't know." So I went to the record center. I actually found the file folder. I pulled out the paper CRF, and what it said was patient found sitting in hallway. How do you anticipate something like that? You just can't. And so we just have to have some level of flexibility and acknowledge that there's going to be things that do change over time, and you're going to have to incorporate that in some way in your reanalysis.
And I think this is where the independent researchers, the users of the data, have a real responsibility, because I think it's impractical to suggest that every time we share data, we rerun our own analyses with the latest versions of the dictionaries before sharing. That simply isn't practical. But at the same time, if an independent researcher applies a current dictionary for their analysis, then inevitably it's likely that it will lead to different results than a dictionary in use 10 years ago. Most of the time, one would hope it won't yield substantially different conclusions, even if the numbers are a little different. But it has that possibility, particularly as dictionaries get more sophisticated over time. And that then leads to why I use the word responsibility. My recommendation would then be it requires collaboration with the sponsor to figure out what is this new information telling us.
Well, one example of that might be biomarkers. There could be a reported value of a biomarker that today doesn't raise an eyebrow, but a few years from now, as we gain more knowledge, you might take that as a sign of something very dire. You just don't know. These things change. As we gain more knowledge, we have to keep updating the way we interpret and the way we analyze.
I think I'd like to end on a final point. Estelle brought up the Duke case, which is a very interesting example from the literature. And I believe that data was available in the public domain, and it was discovered through a reanalysis that there were a number of data issues and methodology issues. Of course, there's the diabetes example we've talked about many times today with the meta-analysis that was performed on rosiglitazone from summary data. So whether the data is publicly available or in a controlled environment, how do we go about having some confidence in terms of how the data is put together, how the analyses are performed, so that at the end of the day, we're not putting out fires based on the analyses people are performing and reporting and potentially publishing?
And I think it all comes back to collaboration. I'd really like to see a responsible, collaborative approach to data sharing where different findings are observed so that we can collectively try and understand, work through them to see what really is the truth of the matter. That would be the ideal scenario, and I think is in the benefit of patients in order to avoid any health scares that are unnecessary, but to ensure that when there is some important new finding, that it's well understood and isn't likely to be discussed and debated in the literature.
I think something else that will help this a lot is to the extent that we can help drive industry standards. So, for instance, to say, what is the standard for doing de-identification? What should we do with adverse events? So as long as we're fractioned and we're doing individual things and each company has its own approach to dealing with this issue, then it's going to be a lot harder to justify what you've done versus compared with someone else has done. But if we can come together and say, well, here are best practices which can be adopted more broadly, more uniformly, then hopefully as those best practices are accepted and endorsed and seen as being valuable, then when people follow it, that will really reduce the potential concern about someone doing something. Because now you're not doing whatever you think is greatest. You're doing something that has been established previously as a good way to do things. So trying to sort of create together something that is vetted by multiple persons. And here's where we also need to make a call to make sure we get the academics involved and the persons working in journals. So it's not just the industry saying this is good for us, but rather the community as a whole saying this is a good way to do things and what we can go from there.
So actually, I think this is a strength rather than a weakness. You know, this different views on data, different views on analysis. And I think that's one of the real strengths of this whole approach is the more information we get out there, the more informed people we have looking at these things, hopefully we can get to better answers and better understanding. And actually, that's one reason we publish papers. That's one reason we give talks. And if you give a talk and everybody just nods in agreement, you probably haven't done anything very interesting. It seems, in my experience at least, if you do something really interesting, people are going to object and say, why did you do it that way? Or that you need to redefine that, or you should have done it differently. And that's fine. That's part of the scientific process.
I think I've just been giving a bunch of uninteresting talks throughout all that. Nobody's objecting to anything I ever say. So Do you have a point, Ted?
I was just going to respond to Mike. So it may be that perhaps the way forward is not so much in terms of identifying everything that works well, but maybe just identifying things that don't work and stay away from those. Because it could be the case that there are multiple good solutions, and they're exchangeable, and you can choose your particular approach for that case. But at least if we can still have a consensus around what the set of good approaches are, even if there might not be a uniform approach for everything, we can still say, here's the set of things that work, and perhaps come out through simulations, other examinations of things to avoid because they don't have the properties we'd like to see. Some kind of reasoned consideration would definitely, I think, be of use.
You think there'll be a standard, perhaps, of sharing data and the analysis methods for peer-reviewed publications that people would potentially have access to do some sort of review before papers are published, particularly in cases where it sort of turns the current thinking on its head?
I mean, it's the kind of area where things like public-private partnerships. So I'm involved with CITI, the Clinical Trials Transformation Initiative, and they do a lot of work with addressing important issues and saying, well, let's pull together academics, physicians, regulators, industry, and try to come up with a consensus view as to what the appropriate approach is here. And I think that type of combined approach is the sort of thing that can be helpful. And it may be that you put together a white paper. It may be that you have a couple-day meeting that you make the slides available. There's lots of ways in which this can then be disseminated. Sometimes it could be that a guidance document is crafted and saying, well, here are the concerns. I think if you look at how our analysis plans for statistics have evolved over time, part of that is that, well, we saw this issue. How does your analysis plan deal with this issue? And that might be a way in which essentially our guidelines for dealing with transparency moved. Well, here was something that was a problem, disclosure of AEs. Here was a thing that was a problem, handling time. Let's get some things out there in terms of four different instances. What are things that we should be doing and should not be doing? And doing this in a collaborative partnership is probably a really good way to consider doing that.
Right. Well, thanks very much for sitting down and talking about data transparency.